It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Welcome to this edition of the Untold Story podcast as we continue to dig into the murders in Idaho of 4 university students. And 2 weeks in, it seems that the latest development is that they know even less than we thought in many ways. But there's a lot moving in this story. And with that, I'm really pleased to be joined by Bill Daley, former FBI, who is an expert in these kinds of investigations and has deep history in this kind of work. So, Bill, welcome. Glad to have you with us today.
Good to be here, Martha.
Bill, for those who don't know you, I always like to start these deeper dives by you giving us a little bit of your background so people can understand what you bring to this story and your own experience with this kind of investigative work.
Sure. Thanks, Martha. And so my career goes back over four decades. I started with the FBI as a young fellow, and I was quickly put into one of the called specialized photography. We did crime scene work, bank robberies, kidnappings, terrorist bombings. So kind of complicated crime scenes, if you will. So at a kind of a young age, I was tossed into that arena, enjoyed it very much. And then over the years, proceeded to do other work within the FBI in special investigations, special surveillance, and other techniques using technical skills. And then after that, going into the private sector, I've been both a partner and managing director at 2 of the largest international security and investigative firms. We've handled large numbers of very complex investigations, ranging everything from kidnapping issues to white-collar crimes, money laundering, tracking down of assets of former governmental leaders outside the U.S., as well as in the corporate sector. So over the years, I've been involved in a number of investigations. So what I bring to bear in this discussion is really kind of the broader base of investigative experience with some of that technical expertise, which has also led me to become a qualified expert and a witness expert and testified in several cases on security and terrorism type of issues.
So it's, you know, when something like this happens and you hear about this crime in Idaho, a vicious crime, and any parent can just imagine what a nightmare this is for these 4 families, their kids living in off-campus house, as so many of our kids have done. And in the middle of the night, someone comes in, we think from the outside, and stabs to death 4 of them. Mm-hmm. The latest that we're hearing from officials in Idaho is that although we were told initially that they had reason to believe this was a targeted attack and they couldn't share the information about why, mm-hmm. now we're hearing that they are not sure that this was a targeted attack. What does that tell you?
Well, I have to tell you, Martha, it is a bit challenging to kind of dissect a statement, even for us kind of stalwart kind of supporters of law enforcement. I think what's happened here is a couple of things. One is that other agencies, so apparently the prosecutor's office has spoken out and either reiterated or expanded upon that notion of it being a targeted crime. At the same time, I think the police, as they've gone through this, perhaps, if we're kind of reading some investigative tea leaves here, have not found any particular stalker, any particular statements, any forensics with regard to maybe computer forensics that indicated that, you know, one or several of the the victims were being targeted. So I think they've kind of walked this back. It does create a bit of concern because people in the community are kind of wondering now, was this just some type of wildly random type of incident? And is that person still loose in the community? So that's very concerning because up to this point, Martha, I tell you, is that I thought the police had done a very good job in containing their communications, even though there's been little of it. In some ways, that's good and been involved in investigations. I know that, you know, providing information when it's not either releasing a suspect's name or helping people try to find an individual, you need to kind of keep your cards close to the vest. But I think having said all that, I think, you know, one of the things that they seem to be saying is that this was not, from what they can tell thus far, a targeted crime. However, I would say that there is some, I'll call it kind of a selection that went on, if anything. Selection meaning that the perpetrator or perpetrators chose the residence for some reason. And I kind of tie this into victimology, and this is what criminologists study in victimology, which is, you know, why is someone more of a target than another person? And so there is something behind it as to why this house at that time was chosen or selected, as I might use the term, and as opposed to, let's say, a residence several miles away that may be a much more rural area where there would be no, you know, kind of risk that that person being caught or interrupted when they commission the crime. So kind of a long way around to say that it is a bit confusing. I don't know whether it totally rules out at some point that there could have been some kind of, we'll put in quotations, targeting, but certainly there was a selection of this residence and then the victims inside of it for some reason, which we'll only know when they catch the individual or individuals.
You know, we're told that there's no evidence of robbery or of rape mm-hmm. or sexual assault
right.
on these victims, which is, I would imagine, is why they sort of say it's a crime. Initially, they said it was a crime of passion because of the violence of this attack. And also, they said early on that they felt that it was probably a first-time killer. Do you agree with those assessments?
Well, you know, I had, and you know, aside from what the police were saying, is that, you know, just in kind of scanning over the years of experience speaking about these kinds of cases, is that, you know, it is a very up close and personal type of attack. When people start using, you know, knives to attack someone, you have to get up close personal. It's not shooting from afar or doing something else. And so I thought that there was some kind of personal connection, you know, with these murders. You know, I would say in that regard, and I'm not trying to kind of, you know, override what the police are saying in this way at all. I don't have any, they're, you know, literally 1,000 more miles away from where I am right now. However, I have seen over the years where an individual is in a workplace incident where individual has felt they were dissed, they were not accepted, there were some other issues. And several years later, without any communication, without any kind of harbingers of things to come, go in and you know, kill former coworkers because they were harboring this resentment, which right. was very deep inside them. So, you know, I'm not trying to dismiss what the police say. I'm just trying to maybe put it in perspective, the fact that they haven't seen anything yet and have walked this back a bit. But it's still a lot of the things kind of point out to the fact that you said there was no robbery, no sexual assault. Then what was the reason for it? Just killing for killing's sake. You know, and to me, you know, that again kind of rings back to someone having some personal motive in it in some fashion.
The Untold Story continues right after this.
The Will Kane Show is now dropping 5 episodes a week. Join Fox and Friends weekend host Will Kane as he tackles the latest headlines from his unique perspective, along with thought-provoking interviews with leading figures and live calls from viewers and listeners. Listen wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
You know, is there a way to tell forensically which victims were killed first? And I ask that because if we think the entry was on the second floor through the sliding door, the first bedroom on the left is Chapin and Kernodle, boyfriend and girlfriend mm-hmm. staying in that room together. Mm-hmm. Then you'd have to go upstairs to the two bedrooms where Gonsalves and Mogan were. You know, can you walk us through perhaps what might have happened here? Because does the killer enter, think that their bedroom is right there, mm-hmm. you know, kill them first, then realize that his target is actually upstairs? What if anything can you make of that? And forensically, can you tell what order the people were killed in?
Well, you know, I'm going to speak to a couple of those issues, and the others are probably left to one of our fellow colleagues, Dr. Michael Bodden, who speaks about the forensic yes. pathology aspect of this, because that comes into play here. You know, but there could very well be kind of a forensic trail. I mean, if you're kind of picturing one of these gruesome crime scenes, is that as someone moves from one place to the other, there could have been, you know, blood that was either on a foot, on a right. shoe, or perhaps dripping in some fashion. You'd also have cross-contamination. If, let's say, one person was killed with the same weapon and they're then stabbed with with that weapon, then you'd have someone else's blood also mixed with the second victim's blood. So you said there's some of those elements that could come into play to help them put some kind of a framework around, you know, who may have been killed first, and may play into, you know, the concern over perhaps the second group of victims being kind of awoken or being kind of made known about the presence of this killer or killers. You know, Martha, it also brings another aspect, which is, and why some of those earlier statements that the police made did kind of, you know, start to ring true for some of us who kind of watching this, is the fact that there were two other people in the residence who were not killed. So if this was some person or persons going in to slaughter individuals just for the sake of killing people and rent, you know, going through a home or going through a house, you would have thought they would have, you know, done that to everyone. So why were only, you know, four of them selected, even if maybe a couple of them were unfortunately awoken or perhaps could have, you know, bore witness against the murderers. So, you know, there's some things about this that we still don't know. And many things, as you pointed out earlier, we don't know. You know, one thing I would say, though, Martha, is that from everything I can kind of read through here is that this is a very complicated crime scene. And by that, I mean, is that you have these victims, you have a perpetrator, perpetrators, you have the other two people in the home. But this house is not like, you know, a single family home where most of the residents are there, where children come and maybe a couple of friends come in periodically or have a workman come in. This was off-campus housing. It had, you know, people coming and going, perhaps staying overnight, people visiting from all different, you know, places. So hairs, fibers, DNA, fingerprints, all that could be, you know, commixed. And so for investigators to go through all this, that's why, you know, it's taking time. This is not a, 60-minute TV melodrama where you kind of, go through the analysis and boy, we have the suspect right away. I think that's why this has become a bit more complicated than people would have perhaps first thought, because there was no immediate giveaway where I call it an aha moment where a person close to the victims kind of surfaced as being a primary suspect.
You know, there's a lot of people who've been ruled out already. The two people who survived, who are in that lower bedroom, and we're going to show people on the show how the house lays out, which I think is helpful, because you can, if you weren't familiar with the home and you entered this home, you can understand how you wouldn't even know that there was someone sleeping in that downstairs bedroom, because the house kind of drops off on the side of a hill and you can enter it from the second floor, sort of as if you're going into the first floor.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think the people who've been ruled out, does that make sense to you, or would you still be looking at them?
I think they probably rule them out for very good reasons, both forensically as well as just having, you know, a certain amount of alibi. I think forensically, I think the people in the home could be ruled out because you would have seen some type of a contamination between where they were, between some of the blood and the other, the other evidence that was in the other rooms was not cross-contaminated to where they were living right downstairs. So, you know, I think for those people, yes. I think other people get further out, have certain alibis, or they have certain reasons why they've ruled them out. You know, this investigative process like this is one that becomes more of kind of a both a science and an art form. The art form is kind of understanding who you may feel as though the closest suspects are. And if you have people who you can kind of more easily rule out, even if later on you have to go back and take a second look, you've kind of put them to the side for very good reasons. You need to kind of keep your kind of investigative, you know, windows open with regard to who might be involved. And so I think they do need to eliminate some of these people and have done it probably judiciously. And with that, I have to say is that, you know, this investigation, again, from what I'm reading and what's been reported, you know, is you know, has a combination of a number of different, you know, experts involved. You have state police, the local police, certainly are there assisting, but I probably say it's more of a state police issue. FBI has been there with behavioral analysis people, as well as certainly be able to give them some support in forensics if they need it as well. So I think, you know, they're looking at this in a very, you know, slow and judicious way. And so people have been eliminated. It probably makes good sense that they have good reason that they were not the suspects.
You know, you would also think that whoever did this would have to discard of all the clothing that they were wearing. The weapon has never been found. Perhaps there's blood in their car. It seems as though that person would be interacting with other people outside mm-hmm. of this crime scene at some point. And we know that there have been hundreds of tips that have come in. But I guess how difficult is it to get away with this kind of murder? Because there's a lot of covering of tracks that has to be done.
Yeah, it would be very difficult. And I, you know, going back to one of the early comments, you know, I've heard other people speak about this and I agree, is that, you know, I don't believe this person is sophisticated. In some ways, they've just been kind of lucky in the first stance that they haven't been caught. So, you know, this is also, we don't have cases around, you know, where these type of murders have been taking place. So, you know, professional murderers? No, that's not what we have here. In fact, two other cases, one in Washington and Oregon that were unsolved, have also been eliminated as being, you know, connected with this case. But to your point, yes, there's a lot of kind of covering your tracks, if you will, if you're the, you know, perpetrator on this. As well, I'd say, Martha, you know, one of the things that later on can start to play into this, and even around these times, is when, you know, people's behaviors, if they are responsible for committing this act, their behavior, you know, not showing up to work, not showing up, you know, being where they should be, acting in a strange way, have disappeared, run off the face, you know, drop the face of the earth type of thing. You know, so, you know, I tie it back to some other crimes over the years that have been solved by people around those individuals who noted, say, oh, well, that's very odd, that's strange behavior. And they've picked up the phone and called. I mean, one of the most notable cases, not to go down too much of a rabbit hole here, but, you know, with Ted Kaczynski, it was when that Unabomber, when he was finally found, it was because people in his family read the note and said, oh, that sounds like Ted. So, you know, later on, that can help investigators, you know, as well as the, all the other things they're doing from a forensic and interview standpoint. It could be someone saying, well, somebody now is kind of acting quite odd. You know, their car is missing, or they've been scouring their car, or they've been doing something else that kind of stands out.
Yeah, absolutely. Bill, thank you very much. This is it's a really difficult case and painful for all these families. We're going to talk to one of the victims' dads. Yeah. Is just, you know, you just feel so much for these families. It's just a horrific story. But thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us, and we look forward to talking with you later. And we'll keep in touch with you on this case. Thank you, Bill.
Great, Martha. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Untold Story with Martha McCallum. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Make sure to rate and review. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com. Listen ad-free with the Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.